Well, welcome everyone. Thank you so much for choosing our lunch symposium. The other room is doing virtual reality. You chose to come to actual reality, so we're happy to do an educational program. I'm David Rubin from the University of Chicago. Joining me is my good friend Miguel Reguero, who is the relatively recently appointed chair of the Department of Gastroenterology and Hepatology and the vice chair of Digestive Diseases and Surgery Institute at the Cleveland Clinic. So we're delighted with Miguel's leadership there, and we're going to have a conversation over your lunch about ulcerative colitis and some of the new advances in the field. It happens to be pretty timely because, as I mentioned yesterday from the podium, the new ACG ulcerative colitis guidelines will be in press this week. So there's a few things that I can comment about those as we go through, and I'll try to give you sort of the highlights. There's a few things I'm not quite at liberty to say because of the way they embargo these things, but you'll get the general idea. Miguel and I, over the years, I've realized practice very similarly, so forgive us that we're going to share some messages that are probably on the same page, but we're interested in your feedback. I also want to acknowledge that this is live streaming, so there are people logged in from all over the world, maybe, checking us out and learning from us here, and we're happy to have them as well. I want to acknowledge our sponsor today, Takeda Pharmaceuticals, who made this CME event possible. So let's start with our first learning objective today, which is to apply approaches to identify moderate to high-risk patients with UC in clinical practice. And as I always like to do, we're going to start with a case to get you all in the clinical mindset so we can focus on how we might think through the management of ulcerative colitis. This is a patient, MG. She's 30 years old. She is currently experiencing 7 bloody stools per day with urgency, and her stool cultures for infectious etiologies, including Clostridioides difficile, are negative. On endoscopic exam, she has extensive colitis, which remember means greater than the splenic flexure, and deep ulcers. So important findings there. We're gonna ask the audience, which factor in this patient, this 30-year-old woman, is most associated with poor prognosis in patients with UC? Older age of onset, early need for steroids, low fecal calprotectin, a family history of ulcerative colitis, a Gabose score greater than 2, that's a histologic index, or you're unsure. So which factor is most associated with poor prognosis? We get to see the answers. So we're gonna teach you a little bit about this, but it looks like we have a pretty experienced audience. What do you think, Miguel?
So I agree. I think that if deep ulcers were on this as one of the options, probably that would have been what I have checked. But I think our early need for steroids is right on, and I agree with that.
What about histology?
So histology is also important, and we're going to come to histology as potentially an endpoint that we're going to be more interested in terms of healing and prediction. So histology and I think early steroids would be both reasonable. Deep ulcers would be another one, but that's not an option.
Right. The FDA is very interested in histology and ulcerative colitis, but they haven't yet given guidance as to how to use it as an endpoint. But we certainly know from some of the research that's been performed that histologic activity is associated with neoplasia, but also histology can predict relapse or even steroid dependence. So it's an interesting and obviously important component of assessment. It's just not a target yet and hasn't been fully incorporated. All right, let's go back to the slides, and I'll let Miguel take you through the traditional classification of UC severity.
Great, well, thank you, David. And I think one of the important aspects that you're hearing at this Congress, but in general, is that we have several different classifications. This is one of the older ones, and you're probably, as clinicians, very familiar with this. We're also going to talk about some AGA pathways that I was involved in, and then David mentioned more recently what he was involved in, the ACG guidelines for ulcerative colitis. So this is the historic way we looked at ulcerative colitis, mild, moderate, severe, and fulminant, largely based on symptoms and certain objective criteria. The problem with this classification is that this is not entirely accurate, and there is some subjectivity. So keep this in mind as we go through, and I think we're going to evolve into a slightly different paradigm.
Many of our patients with ulcerative colitis have progression of their UC, and of course we traditionally think of progression more in Crohn's disease, where we talk about inflammation progressing to obvious fibrostenosis. But in ulcerative colitis, there's actually progression that can be described in as well. One of the classic ways that progression is described in UC is related to endoscopic progression from extent of disease. So a patient presents with limited extent. In adults, about 70% of them will present with inflammation that's less than their entire colon, and it may progress in up to 50% of people. For those who joined us this morning for our very early symposium, you heard us discuss that progression from limited extent of colitis to pancolitis is actually a prognostic factor in itself. The other things that we see when we talk about progression in UC is a change in histology. And so there's an animation here that demonstrates some of the changes that we see with histologic activities, and you can consider that as a progression. Of course, progression from non-neoplasia to neoplastic findings could be considered progression. And there's very interesting work that suggests that over time, people with chronic colitis may also have progression where their colon actually becomes less functional or less permeable in different ways, so the colon is no longer working. So for those patients of yours in your experienced practice who are in remission otherwise, maybe by scope or even biopsies, but are still having symptoms, we're learning that that may actually be due to structural abnormalities of the large intestine, just like we think about with Crohn's, only less well described. So the implication of all those comments, of course, is that uncontrolled progressive inflammation has a prognostic factor, can affect people in a negative way, and therefore we want to control the disease and try to prevent it. It used to be that patients could live with UC or thought that if they could get by with their active disease, they were okay. And we now know that there are many different potential outcomes when that happens, and we'd like to try to avoid that. So when you look at the progression of histologic activity, you can see not only that it can go from the early signs of an inflammatory infiltrate with architectural distortion, but actually what's now been shown is not only progression to more substantial inflammation and even collagen deposition, but very interestingly, the opposite is true. We now have reported that people who are under good control for a period of time actually can have normalization of their histology. So normalization, you probably have had a patient or two where you're sure they had ulcerative colitis from prior evaluations and your care, and then you do a colonoscopy for screening or surveillance, and lo and behold, your biopsies in parts of the colon or the rectum come back and they're read by your experienced pathologist as actually normal. In the early days, our pathologists used to tell us that they saw that, but they didn't report it because we told them they had UC. So they'd call subtle things. And when we finally told them that it was okay to say that this looks normal again, lo and behold, 10% of our patients in stable remission having surveillance exams really normalized. So now you want to know what happens to normal histology. Are these patients who are better in the long term? Well, in fact, in a follow-up study that our group published in CGH in 2017, our advanced IBD fellow Britt Christensen showed that people who had normal histology did better even than those who had quiescent histology in terms of likelihood of relapse. And the next question you want to know is, can you take the medications away in people who normalize? Is this some new level of deep remission? And we haven't quite sorted that out yet, but we'll be presenting at ECHO in a couple weeks and then hopefully at DDW some of the follow-up of people who normalized. And lo and behold, having normal histology does not predict that these patients can be off all their therapies. Some of them definitely still relapse. So that's an update on how to think about not just progression from a histologic point of view, but even the possibility of regression from a histologic point of view, which is a fascinating concept. You want to tell us about the AGA clinical pathway?
Sure. So this was a pathway that I was involved in, and this is something that's actually downloadable on your phone as an app. And these pathways are very simple in terms of clinical practice. I think probably many of you use this intuitively when you see your patients in practice in terms of how you stratify your risk. The colectomy risk, I would also say, would be a good way of looking at what is early biologic treatment. So if I look at ulcerative colitis of two flavors, if you will, the mild and the severe. The mild are patients who usually respond to a course of steroids and then they do well with some type of mesalamine or 5-ASA. The more advanced patients are what we present on this slide here on the right-hand side. So these are younger patients. One of the answers in the question that David presented is older. Actually, younger onset has more severe predictable factors with colectomy. Extensive disease, high inflammatory markers, steroids at an early time. So those that answered steroids early, that I agree with. But probably most importantly, and this is what I tell our fellows, if you do a sigmoidoscopy on a new onset patient and you see deep ulcerations, that is probably the poorest prognosis in terms of the risk of colectomy. And that is a patient that we should not step through 5-ASA. In my opinion, these are the patients that we need to hit hard and we need to start biologic or some biologically active medication. We do know also that infections are bad. So you've seen this in your practices as well. C. diff patients in UC manifest in a very different way, probably from immunologic switch that we're starting to understand more on a microbiome level. But these are the patients that progress more to surgery. We also need to, by the way, when we treat the C. diff, not forget about the colitis. So there's been concern about different immunosuppressive therapies. Steroids are bad, probably even C. diff is not a good answer, but certainly things like anti-TNFs, even the integrins, and even our other small molecules are medicines that we should not ignore to treat the ulcerative colitis. And then finally, if you have a patient who's hospitalized early, this is important. Low risk is just the converse, and I won't read through all of those, but the low risk patients are probably those patients that do quite well. So I guess, David, one question for you in terms of, and we're gonna get to this in a minute with colectomy, but I'm just curious, the patient that comes in high risk that you see these deep ulcers, how do you approach that patient? And this comes up quite a bit when we're positioning therapies. What's your approach to that patient?
Well, the first thing I wanna emphasize is the AGA care pathway is a very useful tool, and it emphasizes something that we have to keep in mind, which is our general approach to managing IBD now, where we're not just talking about disease activity, which is how sick they are right now, which is important, of course, but also thinking about disease severity or prognosis. And the way the care pathway did it is they divided patients into high risk or low risk, as you see nicely on this slide. The way the new UC guidelines from the ACG do it is we talk about the difference between activity and severity, and in fact, there's an activity index and then a separate table of patients at high risk for colectomy. So back to Miguel's question, if I have a patient who presents who has deep ulcerations, I know from good evidence that this patient is a higher risk for colectomy, and I also know that they are less likely to respond to 5-ASA or corticosteroids. So I'm going to be earlier moving towards a more effective therapy, whether it's a biological therapy, and we have some wonderful options, or whether I would even consider a JAK inhibitor in that situation. Now, the other component of this is that we've all come to realize that even moderately active colitis has associated with it a substantial amount of protein loss. So we've come to appreciate the pharmacokinetics of monoclonal antibodies in the setting of colons that are inflamed, in which the therapy, which is a protein itself, may actually be getting cleared more rapidly due to leak. And so when I see severe colitis, I also worry that whatever treatment I'm gonna choose may have difficulty getting to the right level to control the disease. I have two other comments to make about this nice care pathway slide. One of them is that, interestingly, your patient with colitis who also has C. diff, important what Miguel said, treat the disease and the C. diff at the same time. We were holding our immunosuppressive therapies previously, and we've learned not only that that is not a good strategy and that patients are likely to do worse, but we actually have started to learn that you might be more successful in getting rid of the C. diff by addressing the underlying IBD at the same time. And for those who are wondering about FMT in this setting, we know that it can help C. diff, but it doesn't treat the IBD. We also know that unlike the non-colitis patients with C. diff, FMT doesn't work quite as well at clearing, and you may need to do more than one if you're choosing that therapy for their C. diff. And the other point about C. diff is very interesting work that looks at outcomes after surgery. And we found at the University of Chicago with a large database of patients who have J pouches that having C. diff prior to colectomy predicted worse pouch outcomes. Now, at first we thought, well, these were sicker patients, maybe they had other complications, but when you adjusted for all that, it still stood up that they were more likely to have leak, more likely to have dysfunctional pouches, and we concluded that maybe there is really something about the microbiome that's changing when these patients have C. diff and when they get treated for it. So keep in mind that this is really a bad marker. When you've got a patient with UC who's flaring and you find that it's C. diff, you really need to be on top of that and try to get them under control quickly and realize that this also is a prognostic marker.
And not to turn this into a C. diff talk, but one final comment. We looked at our pouch outcomes at Cleveland Clinic, and two of the more important parameters related to C. diff and UC also was high-dose steroids preoperatively and narcotics. So narcotics and high-dose steroids also impacted outcome postoperatively. So in your patients that come in with a lot of pain and ulcerative colitis, the knee-jerk in the emergency room is IV dilaudid. We need to get away from that. The other knee-jerk is we do not want to ramp up their steroids. I completely agree with David. We can use biologically active medications, but we should avoid high-dose steroids and avoid narcotics. And our colorectal surgeons, we've seen some very bad outcomes in patients who have to go to surgery with bad C. diff, narcotics, and steroids.
And just lastly, for those who were at the guidelines talks yesterday, we've now embraced vancomycin as your first-line antibiotic treatment for C. diff rather than metronidazole. And that's consistent for your IBD and your non-IBD patients. So hopefully you're up to date on that as well. Now, we talked about this already, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time. Just remind you that up to 50% of your patients with left-sided disease or proctosigmoiditis may have extension. And so monitoring people who have UC and who are under treatment should include a periodic assessment of the extent of their disease. And certainly your patient who is previously stable, doing well, who relapses, you need to be thinking about whether the disease has progressed. And the reason that they are not doing well now is because the disease has changed in some way. What are the predictors of progression? We don't know. It would be nice to know if it was because they're not in deep remission or whether they're adherent to the therapies we've recommended, but that actually hasn't been proven yet. But in theory, that makes some sense to me. The other one has to do with the rate of surgery, and you could think of colectomy as a predictor or at least associated with progression of colitis. Interestingly, more and more, and we saw a nice study yesterday from Calgary looking at colectomies associated with cancer, but in general, colectomies associated with UC have been decreasing. When I was a fellow, which wasn't that long ago, it was about 30%, and now people are talking more about 10% or so. So that may reflect more effective therapies. The other option would be to consider that it may reflect a changing type of UC that's emerging in our populations. Maybe it's not as aggressive as it used to be. I'm not sure. What do you think about that?
I think, so I don't know why we're seeing less. I think we're getting better at treatment is number one. I actually think we are seeing more aggressive, especially in young males. Young male patients, if there are any pediatricians in the room, seem to be as an especially refractory disease onset, high rates of colectomy despite therapy. So I think it's just generally we're recognizing it earlier and we're treating more aggressively.
Fabulous. Of course, looking at hospitalizations as a predictor of disease progression or as an outcome of interest, the longer patients have had UC, the more likely they are to have hospitalization. I'm not sure that these data would hold up if we look at the more modern approach to management. Because the patients who were followed long enough to show hospitalization, number one, kept their colon, and number two, go back to an era where we certainly didn't have all the options currently available to us. I can tell you that at the University of Chicago, where we have a dedicated IBD inpatient unit, that our hospitalization rate has gone down significantly, even with the complex patients we see. So what are you seeing at Cleveland and previously at Pittsburgh?
So I think Pittsburgh and Cleveland may be a little bit different. So Cleveland, we have a large referral center for surgery. So some of these patients are coming in. So take that aside. I agree with David that we're seeing less hospitalizations. And also we're seeing and realizing that we're not lingering on high-dose oral corticosteroids as an outpatient. I think all of you in the room are probably practicing in the sense that you're moving to the next treatment very quickly. And if the next treatment's not working at a very quick rate, whether it's a higher dose of a monoclonal antibody or an oral small molecule, you're probably getting that patient to see the surgeon. And now we're seeing patients admitted either electively for surgery, and then there are still some of those rare patients who come in with fulminant colitis, often with C. diff in the background. So I agree with what you said as well.
And of course, cancer remains a concern, although the rate is barely above the general population now. And of course, we reflect that that likely is because of surveillance colonoscopies, because of the good work you're doing, because of hopefully our newer therapies controlling inflammation. But nonetheless, the risk is still increased. Are we doing more scopes than we should? Probably. The new UC guidelines from the ACG will help guide you as to how you might approach some of these patients, and maybe that can come up during the Q&A. And as I already mentioned to you, there is actually a measured dysmotility and some anorectal dysfunction. The old lead pipe colon seen on barium x-rays and now sometimes seen on your CT scans is an important marker, not just of a colon that's probably dysfunctional and a patient who may be very uncomfortable because of it, but also it in and of itself is a separate marker for dysplasia and subsequent risk, presumably because it reflects prior severe inflammation.
And don't ignore, as David presented on the last slide, the patient who starts with bad diarrhea and over a long period of time feels constipated. So I have to remind my fellows that constipation and ulcerative colitis is a bad sign. Either they've developed the cancer, but more likely, if you look at the other damage at the bottom of the slide, functionally that part of the lower colon isn't working, they're getting more rigid. These are also the patients, by the way, like the Crohn's strictures, probably are not going to respond to medical therapy as well. So we need to avoid this state. So I guess we can go to the next slide. So I think this is, just to put this into context of your practices in terms of endoscopic and clinical remission, which are the dark bars. Red is clinical remission alone, but still with endoscopic activity of disease. And then finally, blue is no clinical response or endoscopic response. And you've heard this mantra before at several of our meetings over the past 5 years, but this really drives home the point that if we have both clinical and endoscopic remission, the rates of colectomy, immunosuppressive therapy, systematic relapse and hospitalization are lower. So essentially what this means is, and I think we see this with ulcerative colitis, we want to get the patient better in terms of symptoms, but we really also want to heal the mucosa. And I think we are moving to a marker of histologic improvement as well. I'm not saying that I use that only as a marker. So if endoscopically this looks normal and they have histologic activity and they're on pretty maximized biologic therapy, I'm not telling you that I would say switch therapy, increase. But just keep in mind that this idea of mucosal healing is important, and I think that this really shows that. And then overall, this is again a reiteration of the colectomy. I won't go into this too much except to say on the far left side, look at the deep ulcer bar. So deep ulcers are bad, higher rates of colectomy. And again, we see patients who have non-healing deep ulcers are the ones we worry about the most.
And it's led us to realize that as much as we like to see a healed bowel, it's important to recognize that it doesn't need to be perfect to change outcomes. And in fact, when they did a post hoc analysis of the original study of infliximab in ulcerative colitis to look at colectomy rates, they found that patients who had normalized endoscopically intact mucosa certainly avoided colectomy, but also the patients who had mild inflammation, who had gone from severe to mild, was sufficient to prevent colectomy. So the message and the reality of practice, because Miguel and I still see lots of patients, is that we like to see improvement, but we recognize we can't always get to perfection, and we don't need to. So we have to keep that in mind, too.
And I think this is, I would put this slide in the context that you've seen this before. So those without endoscopic activity, and that's the top line, have lower rates of colectomy than those who still have endoscopic activity. And let me just tell you how I practice, and I think David and I practice similarly. So you have a patient in your office, bad ulcerative colitis, you start on whatever biologic or small molecule. My practice has now evolved that it's 6 months to a year, and depending on their CRP and if I'm checking fecal calprotectin whether I do a scope at 6 months or I do a scope at a year. These are the data that essentially drive us to make decisions. So if at 6 months a patient still has activity, high inflammatory markers, we are really very aggressively moving to the next step. However, if they've completely healed the bowel, and as David said, and it's unlikely at a year within biologic therapy, their histology is entirely normal, but if they're endoscopically normal at that point, it doesn't mean stop therapy. It means that we need to continue the therapy, but also let the patient know that maybe their next colonoscopy will be a year after that. So to simply put, what I do in my practice, anybody starting on biologic, 6 months to a year later, I repeat a colonoscopy. If it's completely normal, my practice, 1 year later, I'll do another colonoscopy. This isn't for surveillance, this is for mucosal activity. At that point, if they have two normal colonoscopies doing well, don't change treatment, then we back off in terms of yearly colonoscopies, and I'll use the surrogate markers of CRP and calprotectin as long as they've been paired to a colonoscopy in the past, meaning that what we see on a colonoscopy is reflected in these markers as well.
My practice is a little different, at least based on what you said. Yeah. When I have patients with high-risk features, I actually will want to repeat some evaluation, whether it's calprotectin that I've paired with previous endoscopy or even a FlexSig, after I finish the loading phase of whatever drug I've chosen. I want to document that we're moving in the right direction. And one of the reasons is because symptoms don't often correlate with the endoscopic findings. So one of the ways I try to explain this to patients is I say, symptom improvement is absolutely necessary. We know it directly correlates to your quality of life, but it's not sufficient. In other words, I'm delighted if you're feeling great and you're much better, but we know that if we want it to last, we should be objectively assessing your inflammatory activity. Now, sometimes this is a disconnect, because for somebody living with active colitis and urgency, when they feel better, they assume their bowel is healed. And for some patients, that's absolutely right. I mean, ulcerative colitis, Jean-Fred Colombel taught me the term, is a noisy disease. When someone has active inflammation of the rectum, they know it and you know it. But the truth of the matter is that you can have persistent inflammation and you can get them halfway up the hill and not realize that you're not at the top. And then they're gonna roll backwards. It's like Sisyphus, the old myth that you can read about later. So what do we know? Well, symptoms are not a reliable indicator of mucosal healing in UC. In fact, there are many studies that have shown this. We can look at our clinical trials and the disconnect between what we find on endoscopy and what we report as the clinical index of remission. Or we can look at a variety of other analyses, including those that now use fecal calprotectin as a way to demonstrate this. And there's some clever studies that have looked at how stress on our patients gives them more symptoms, but the calprotectin doesn't even go up in that setting. So you can go in both directions here to understand what might be going on. And I'm really delighted that the new UC guidelines embrace CalPro, not only in the activity index, but also in the recommendations for your management. So hopefully that'll help you in your practice.
So I think we now move into what do we know about measuring the outcomes of mucosal healing. You've heard us introduce this already. And if we can go to the next slide, we can look at how mucosal healing is defined. And you've heard this before. So there's either this endoscopic normalization, absence of ulcerations, or at the bottom, histology. And I think as gastroenterologists, and I'm certainly not a pathologist, so I need to rely on our pathology colleagues, just know that there's the Gabose score, Nancy histology, and the Robarts index. You'll hear more about these if you haven't heard about these already, as David alluded to. I think the FDA and other agencies are looking at histology in a bit of a different way. And I think these are scores that you need to at least familiarize yourself with, or at least very much so work with a pathologist that's comfortable reading out. I will tell you candidly, as I get a lot of referrals, and as David alluded to, I still see a lot of patients, where we get pathology from somewhere outside that says mildly active inflammation, and then it lists every differential. This could be NSAIDs, ischemia, infection, ulcerative colitis, IBD. And I don't know what to do with that. So sometimes having a pathologist that really can clarify what the histology looks like is extremely important.
I'll just add that if you want to remember one thing about histology, there has been an emerging consensus that histologic remission is defined as the absence of neutrophils. So try to remember that one signpost, because that's what you're going to hear more about as histology becomes an area of interest, not just for our management, but of course in future clinical trials. And we've talked already about CalPro, so I'm going to move us along.
So I think the goals we've talked about as well in terms of inducing remission and having endoscopic healing. The patient-reported outcomes, the PRO2, if you've heard that term, patient-reported outcome 2 for Crohn's is abdominal pain and diarrhea. For ulcerative colitis, it's diarrhea and bleeding. I would also mention, I think an important symptom to look out for is tenesmus. That, as I described to the patient, that dry heave of the rectum is very, as I like the Jean-Fred, it's a noisy disease. These are patients, if they have inflammation in the rectum, they'll often have that. We want to maintain steroid-free remission and then avoid the complications that we already talked about at the bottom, but also look at cost of care. So I think we'll move more now into the pathways a bit and talk to you, maybe we can go even to the next slide in terms of the algorithm. So what do you do? And these are pathways, again, that you can download on your phone. These are very simple to use. We make the diagnosis, and then we essentially put the patient into two flavors, that low and that high risk, based on what we had said before. The low-risk patients, usually we don't talk about much at these conferences because they do well with 5-ASAs. They see you once a year, and ultimately they go through some surveillance for dysplasia. The high-risk patients are really the ones that we focus on. So the next slide, and then maybe we can keep moving along. So actually, let's get back to the case, and then I think we have another audience response. So get ready to answer the next question. So remember, this is the 30-year-old, 7 bloody bowel movements, stools are negative. However, she has extensive disease and deep ulcers. So at this point, if we go to the ARS, what would be your first step in treating her? Short course of steroids with thiopurines, TNF, vedolizumab with immunosuppressions, tofacitinib, or you're still not sure. So hopefully we're not confusing you. So most of you answered TNF. Actually, David, maybe I'll ask you to reflect on this and then I can give you my opinion as well. How would you have answered this?
Well, first of all, I think the audience is clued in here that this is a high-risk patient because they didn't choose the 5-ASA option, which wasn't given. and they avoided the thiopurine, which we've talked a lot about, and we can think about that as a group. But they're going right to some of our other options here. So they chose TNF inhibitors, 60%. 20% of them chose Veto with or without an immunosuppressant. And we can talk about that because some of the people in the audience have asked that question already. Do you use it in combination? And some in the audience also said, well, why not use the JAK inhibitor, small molecule, instead? And maybe one person wasn't quite sure. So I don't think that there's a wrong answer from the TNF, Veto, or TOFA choices. But I will tell you that if the endoscopy looks bad, and I would add another parameter we didn't tell the audience, if they had a low albumin.
Right.
I'm always inclined to think that this person might need some help getting that bowel under control before I can get them to a biological therapy, and I worry about that. Or at a minimum, I know I might need more drug up front, and we all recognize how challenging that can be with payers. So I actually would be leaning towards a combination approach in some way, certainly steroids plus anti-TNF, steroids plus Veto, which is favorable. And I haven't been using Veto any longer as a combination approach, especially when I'm using it as my first biologic. The immunogenicity is low. In our own experience, it was very low. In the clinical trials, it was low. And I'm not as worried about that.
So this is where we practice the same. So one thing I'll mention, when I do use anti-TNFs in any condition, I do use it paired with an immunomodulator, so thiopurine or methotrexate. And that's primarily for immunogenicity, and I still will practice that way, and at least for the first year, I'll do that. Now, there are exceptions to every rule, and if I don't use a combination approach, I will use proactive therapeutic drug monitoring in those patients. As David mentioned, for vedolizumab as first-line therapy, I do not use combination. I think you negate the safety effect of vedolizumab with combination. Also, the immunogenicity is in the order of 2 to 2.5%. It's very low. And then finally, tofacitinib, just to drive home this point that you probably know already, I never use a combination approach. However, I will overlap with a short course of steroids if needed. Tofacitinib also works fairly quickly. So if it is working quickly, I get them off steroids. But I do not use thiopurine, and I will not use methotrexate with tofacitinib.
Yeah, so I'll make a couple additional points. If you're worried the patient may be leaking, then they're especially going to have a risk for immunogenicity with their anti-TNF therapy because of what we call pseudo-episodic therapy. In other words, you give the drug, but because they're leaking or they're having high clearance or they have a high inflammatory burden, the drug is going to bottom out in their system. Then you give them their second loading dose, and it's like getting an episodic exposure, and therefore it drives up immunogenicity. So completely agree with Miguel that when I'm treating patients with anti-TNF who have this type of colitis or more severe disease, I am absolutely using combo therapy, at least up front, to try and protect them from this. And I'm also, I have adopted a post-loading drug level when I use anti-TNF in high-risk patients. That means that immediately prior to their maintenance dosing, I check a drug level, because we now know that that predicts loss of response at 6 months or 1 year. Very importantly, why should we wait for a high-risk patient to lose response after they finish loading? And I've started doing that in some of my high-risk veto patients as well, and I think it's reasonable. Why not TOFA right off the bat? It's a small molecule. It doesn't have the risk of having the leakage that we've talked about, and it's a reasonable thing to consider. TOFA and veto were both approved with the option of not needing to fail other therapies before you get to it, certainly not failing TNF inhibitors. So it is an option to consider. One of the challenges may be payers and whether they're ready to let us use it in that setting. But I think we're going to hear more about that, and we should be thinking about that as another way to think about this.
And final point, just to add on to David, if I use veto in this case, because you can't do an increased waist-based dosing, sometimes I will give the three-dose induction closer together, and then when I move to maintenance, I'll often go to every 4 weeks. Now, you do have to fight the insurers a little bit with that. With the anti-TNF, if they're in the hospital, I give the 10 milligram per kilogram. Usually by 3 to 5 days, if they're not turning the quarter, I'll give them the second 10 milligram per kilogram, and if they fail those two, they go to colectomy. It's interesting where tofacitinib will move in the inpatient realm. We don't have enough data. There's a Michigan study looking at even higher dose. I think we all have experience in the hospital where it may work, and we can go through some anecdotal stories.
So, of course, the case example isn't a hospitalized patient, but I will add that, as some in the room know, I'm in favor of cyclosporin when patients have low albumin with severe colitis and are in the hospital. And we just published our experience using cyclo and tacrolimus as a bridge to vedolizumab. So using a non-biological therapy for induction to try and heal the bowel or get it under control, and then bridge to the safe option of vedolizumab. So different ways to think about that. If you want to read that, that's actually in the printed edition of CGH right now in your mailbox at home or on your table unwrapped. Okay, so when to introduce biologics in patients with UC? The steroid refractory patient, the steroid dependent patient, the immunomodulator refractory patient, the immunomodulator intolerant patient, and those who have a clinical predictor of a poor outcome, which we've talked a lot about. I'll throw another pearl to all of you. We just had a paper accepted in JCC, the European Crohn's and Colitis Journal. We were able to show that if you have a patient with a persistently high fecal calprotectin, it predicted steroid dependence. So if you have a patient who's on steroids responding, and you're about to start a steroid taper and you're on the fence because you know how sick they were or how risky they are, you can consider that as a way to know whether they're going to do well when you start dropping their steroids. So that's an interesting, you know, a lot of times we end up waiting until they get down to 20 or 15 milligrams to find out they're steroid dependent. But now we might have a better marker of that. So the approved therapies for moderate to severe UC, we've touched base on. In the US, we have three anti-TNF therapies. Of course, infliximab, which also now has three approved and available biosimilars in the US, and adalimumab and golimumab as injectables, neither of which have available biosimilars, although adalimumab has a couple that got approved. They're just not going to be on the market for a few more years. Vedolizumab, of course, also approved. And tofacitinib, the most recently approved drug for moderate to severe outpatient UC. The adverse event profiles differ between these therapies, and in part you can blame that on the mechanisms, right? We understand a lot about our anti-TNF risks predominantly with infections, especially opportunistic infections or reactivation of latent TB, and we know because of the gut selective nature of vedolizumab that the side effect profile has overall been favorable, as has the long-term follow-up of that. And with TOFA, we think of it as being similar to our other immunomodulators in that it's a pretty potent immunosuppressant. That's why it works so fast. And we see viral replication, or at least that's why we've seen an increase in zoster, which isn't that different in reality to what we report out with TNF. It just came up in the clinical trials. It's important, and it's something that we're trying to address by vaccinating people who get TOFA. So when we look through our therapies, we can just see some general reports of the response and remission data with the anti-TNFs. The best was with infliximab, and although better than placebo, adalimumab and golimumab were significant, but not as much. And then in maintenance, we certainly see that these therapies all work well, but the reality is that we have to accept the fact that their maintenance success at 6 months or 1 year is substantially less, even after doing well with loading. This is why, in your high-risk patients, why are we waiting for them to fail and bounce back into our clinics with all these problems? We should really be proactive to understand what's happening. So I haven't bought into proactive therapeutic monitoring for everybody on stable maintenance therapy, but I definitely have incorporated checking a level after loading in my high-risk patients before we move into maintenance phase so I can understand what's going on with them. Vedolizumab had incredible phase 3 results in the Gemini 1 study, looking at all their endpoints, the primary and secondary endpoints, much better than placebo. It's clearly a very effective therapy for UC, and even interestingly, some data now suggests that your patients with Crohn's colitis may do a little better than Crohn's ileitis, suggesting perhaps a mechanism that favors that approach. Very interesting, but nonetheless, obviously a good option to consider in our patients, both for induction and for maintenance. And then we also recognize, as has been discussed this morning and throughout the meeting, the question of which drug to use first. So we've learned that for a variety of different reasons, one of which may be as simple as just how long the patient's disease is active, but the first drug you pick is going to be the one that you get the most out of. So looking at a post hoc analysis of the patients who were TNF naive in the Gemini study of vedolizumab compared to those who were previously exposed, you can see that patients who were TNF naive were more likely to respond to vedolizumab. So if you're going to consider this therapy as your biologic of choice in a patient with UC, you should use it early if you can and start it right away. By the way, in the UK, the NICE guidelines have adopted and allow vedolizumab as the first-line biologic. In the U.S., it's market-dependent and regional. I bet many people here are in different places where they may or may not be able to get it as their first drug. The new UC guidelines from the ACG suggest that an organ-selective approach, when available, is appropriate and should be considered. And lastly, TOFA, which got approved in May of this year, of this past year. We've already talked a little bit about it. I'll just remind you, the induction phase with TOFA is 10 milligrams twice daily for 8 weeks. And unusual for the FDA, they approved options for maintenance of either 5 milligrams BID or 10 milligrams BID. And the reason they did that is because when you looked at the clinical trial data, the patients who had been previously TNF exposed did better in maintenance on 10 BID. So that's a pearl for you. And when you're thinking about using that therapy, you're trying to figure out what to do in maintenance phase. Your higher risk patients or those who have failed other therapies are probably the ones who should stay on the higher dose in maintenance. And just to quantify the shingles risk for those trying to get their hands around this, the risk in induction during those first 8 weeks of 10 BID is about 1%. And the risk in maintenance over time is about 5%. It's not inconsequential. We've had a couple patients with shingles who are young, otherwise well patients who get it, and it's real. And so we're trying to vaccinate our patients before they have that complication. So Miguel?
Miguel, but as far as the pathways, I think we've talked about this already. The anti-TNF, Vedo, TOFA, those losing response to or failing prednisone, anti-TNF, Vedo, and TOFA are the three that we would use. As far as loss of response to anti-TNF, you've seen this many times in terms of therapeutic drug monitoring. I'm not going to repeat this again. Those that lose response to vedolizumab, we can check levels, but also in a standard way, I am starting to go to every four-week dosing for these patients. And then as far as how to choose the next ulcerative colitis therapy, I guess this is back to you unless you want me to keep going.
Well, we've covered this a bit. Obviously, we want to choose the therapy that's going to be the most effective and have a balance with safety. And I always tell patients, and I've tried to tell my fellows and colleagues, that the risk to benefit ratio and the perception of it changes after the patient responds to the therapy. So the hypothetical risks are always concerning and scary when someone's reading about the therapy on the internet or hearing about it from us or looking on social media. But the reality is if they respond to the therapy and are now in remission, the willingness to accept risks that are rare or at least are not reported very often becomes much more acceptable to a patient. And that general principle of treating to achieve a goal, you've now all heard, hopefully, treating to a target. This is a way that even if you choose one therapy or another, or unfortunately a payer requires you go down a specific pathway before you get to something else, you can do so in a systematic way. So just remember that treating to a target doesn't mean, A, that the target is the same for every patient. It's not. You choose an individualized target, and you see more often than not, we might want the bowel to be healed, but there are many other ways to think about it. Number B, it doesn't mean that you have a set way of doing it, but it does mean that you're going to systematically evaluate the disease after certain intervals that you predefine. So for the individual therapy you choose, when are you going to reevaluate to see if you're on your way to the target? So you heard my example where I'm going to usually look after 3 months or after the loading phase. That's the first time I look and when I adjust it. You've heard both of us say we do a post-loading drug level. That's another way to have a sense of, are you on your way to your target? And notice that the graphic I created on treat to target is a circle, because it's not sufficient to just get to the target and be done. Managing chronic diseases includes continuous monitoring and keeping your eye on it, because chronic disease, especially one where we're treating the consequence of the disease and not the cause, will have a tendency to drift away from center and become active again, even when you're using a specific mechanism. The theory behind that, by the way, is whatever's driving the colitis is being controlled for some period of time on your treatment. And then the body, which is miraculous in many different ways, just finds a collateral inflammatory pathway. So when you accept that idea, and if you believe that might be true, you can also accept the possibility that you might be able to cycle back to a therapy that had stopped working previously. So imagine a patient did wonderfully on an anti-TNF, lost response to that, not due to immunogenicity, but just stopped working. And you go to vedolizumab and it works beautifully, and then they lose response to that. You might be able to go back to anti-TNF as a mechanism. There's some rationale for that and emerging data. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and I think one point that I also wanted to mention in terms of early treatment, I think the first 2 to 3 months are the most important. And just to drive home one point that we keep making, if you have initially high CRP or fecal calprotectin with a bad colonoscopy, it's reasonable to use that marker, whether it's once a month, once every 2 weeks, and just make sure that's driving down to normal. So when you do your next scope, might be also dependent on that fecal calprotectin and CRP. If that marker is normal when your scope looks bad, then I do think a sigmoidoscopy is probably going to need to do at least as an early measure for UC.
Sure. And remember that the best sample for a CalPro is the first stool of the day. Remind your patients of that. So the targets, what should they be? We've talked about this. I think we've covered this already. But the point is a composite endpoint of symptom improvement and objective assessment of the disease control. And remind your patients of that up front, that we want them to feel better, of course. That's essential, but it's not sufficient. So back to our case, and then I'm going to hit the questions because there's a very thoughtful group of people in the audience with some good questions for us, Miguel. So this 30-year-old woman with 7 bloody stools per day and has extensive colitis with deep ulcers, and we had asked the audience to consider what we might do. Well, we're going to move on to the next level of this case. So TNF inhibitor monotherapy was introduced for her which resulted in remission. So remember that 60% of you wanted to do that anyway. And treatment was continued for maintenance, except after 4 months, she lost response. And you've obtained a drug level, which shows there's plenty of drug and no anti-drug antibodies. Now what would you do? So let's see where people want to go. Do you want to increase the dose of her existing anti-TNF? Do you want to add an immunomodulator? Do you want to cycle to another anti-TNF? Would you swap, that's the term that means change mechanism, to Veto? Would you swap to TOFA, or you're not sure? Okay, so we got lots of swappers in the room. A few people want to increase the dose. What do you think about that, Miguel?
So I think it depends on the level. Generally, I would change mechanism of action. If you simply put it that they have enough drug to do the job without antibodies, then I would switch.
What does enough drug mean?
So enough drug would be 10, depending on the levels that you're looking for. So 3 to 7 were the trials, 5 to 10 were what we pushed to, and now we realize if we have a level of 10 for infliximab or above, that's a good level. So assuming and presuming that the level's 10 or even 10 to 15, then I would definitely switch. If they're 5 without antibodies, then maybe you could increase it. So we didn't give you the number of the level, but that's how I practice. And switching to Veto or tofacitinib, I think would be the correct answer. I think more of you said Veto. Maybe some of that's also insurance driven. But I think either of those would be the right answer.
Well, we certainly like the safety of Veto. I heard Ed Loftus yesterday say something that really resonated with me, which was the number regarding the drug level isn't always as important as what's going on clinically. So from my point of view, the way I think about some of this is if the patient still has a response when they get their infusion, they have some improvement, and that's where they say, I know when I'm feeling it and I'm going to need the drug, and when I get it, it lasts a week or two, I'm going to think, can I squeeze more out of it? Is there going to be benefit to giving more of it or adding an immunomodulator in theory? Maybe. If the level comes back and it's super high, I'm not sure if that's possible, but if I'm hearing that history of what we might call attenuation, then it's reasonable to think about trying to stick with it. And certainly the easy thing in clinical practice to just say, get your next dose early and let's see what happens. But the reality is that if they tell me that they've lost response, nothing's happening, they got their last infusion, you're sure they're not infected and they're active, I definitely am going to swap to a different mechanism. So there are some questions that are related to this that came up before they even knew we were going to ask about it. So I'm going to ask you, Miguel. So if you're going to go from an anti-TNF to vedolizumab, in other words, Veto is your second line biologic, and they lost response to their first line, would you do Veto with an immunomodulator?
It depends. So what it depends on is whether or not the patient has antibodies to the infliximab. So if they're not an antibody former, they're not immunogenic to the drug, I use vedolizumab as monotherapy. If they've been on infliximab and they have high antibodies, I would more likely use combination. I would definitely use combination with Veto if they've been through 2 or 3 anti-TNFs with immunogenicity to each of those. So I think the antibody formation and the antibody formers will influence my decision. Otherwise, I use monotherapy Veto.
Good. Some really thoughtful questions. Hyperbaric oxygen, should that have been one of the options?
Reasonable option, difficult to get paid for, even though it's a cheap test, but the hyperbaric tanks for ulcerative colitis, interestingly, we've been doing this a little bit at Cleveland Clinic for bad perianal Crohn's and a little bit for UC. It works. It's just hard. Patients have to come back frequently, and it doesn't get paid for.
Not quite there yet, right? A few people wanted us to just clarify, what is a post-loading dose? When do you actually do it?
Yeah,
so level?
So usually I do it 4 weeks after the third induction dose.
Okay, I usually do it as a trough right before they're due for their maintenance. So for Veto and infliximab, that's week 14. If you're doing adalimumab, that might be more like week 12 or somewhere around there. You can figure that out.
And the only reason I differ slightly, and I know for time purposes I won't go through too much, if at 4 weeks after the third dose they're low, I have the opportunity to adjust their first maintenance dose earlier. If you wait for the trough, which is not unreasonable, then you just have to catch up a little bit.
So is there a desired level when you check the post-loading level? Would you adjust beyond, is it 10 for you? for anti-TNF,
right.
Or what do you do?
So answer is we don't know. I do target between 5 and 10, and this is where I think what David said a minute ago, it depends on how the patient's doing. CRP is negative, fecal calpro is 50, they're feeling well, their level's 5, I leave them alone.
Routine calprotectin in maintenance, do you ever do it?
No.
I do. Okay, once or twice a year, depending on the patient, how risky they might be, and whether I've done other things to them, but not in everybody, not in everybody. Okay, there's a sophisticated question here, well, a couple questions about vaccination for herpes zoster. So let's start with the one that comes up a lot. These are young patients often, and they go to the pharmacy to get their shingles vaccine, and they're told that they're not 50 and insurance won't pay for it. So how are you managing that, and what is the general approach?
Yeah, so three brief comments. One, I do think we probably should be vaccinating all of our patients for Shingrix, and this is starting to enter our realm of reality. Two is what goes against reality is there's been a national shortage and we haven't been able to get Shingrix, so even in our over 50 patients, it can be very difficult. And third is what David said, under 50 years of age, the payment issue. And then there are two options at that point. You can fight, and we've been successful sometimes in getting that paid for. The patient sometimes elects to pay for it out of pocket, which can be about $200, depending on where you are and what the benefit is. And some of our patients just say they go ahead and pay for it. I do think at some point we are going to vaccinate our younger patients against Shingrix.
If you go to the CDC website, they have something called their Advisory Board for Immunization Practices. And there's a sub-paragraph within their advice about shingles vaccination that talks about at-risk populations. And an at-risk population is defined as, among other things, as a patient on immunosuppressants. So we actually print out that and give it to the patient when they go to the pharmacy, and we've been trying to push along on that. Now, out of fairness, I'll tell you that the Shingrix vaccine hasn't been officially studied for patients on immunosuppressants. Now, that's not to say it's dangerous, because it's an attenuated vaccine. It's not a live vaccine. But it's to say that it's not clear if it's as immunogenic at converting to active immunity as it is in the non-immunosuppressed population, but we think it is. Now, the more complicated question is this. If you have a patient who is vaccinated for chickenpox, do they need to be vaccinated against shingles? And the answer is yes, because the varicella vaccination is a live virus. So they have that in their system and they need to be protected against getting shingles. If they have not been vaccinated, and as far as they know, they never got chicken pox, do you vaccinate them? And the answer is maybe. Sorry, I can't give you a better answer, but that's what my infectious disease folks and my pharmacists have all come up with. And if the patient has no idea, unfortunately, checking a varicella titer is not reliable as a way to know whether you should do it or not. So for the most part, err on that side.
And one other pearl with Shingrix, know that the second vaccine in these patients sometimes does induce a fairly profound flu-like response. So I have some of my physician colleagues who tell me their second dose they'll take on a Friday, where over the weekend they don't need to do anything. I don't know if any of you have had Shingrix, but that's separate than IBD. Just I warn my patients about that as well.
Yeah, it's potent. All right, let's do one last ARS because it addresses some of the other questions that this great audience has come up with. MG was switched to vedolizumab monotherapy, which most of them wanted to do, and it resulted in remission, and treatment was continued for maintenance. After about 3 months, she's pregnant. How would you proceed? Stop treatment while she's pregnant and breastfeeding. Continue treatment at a reduced dose while she is pregnant and breastfeeding. Continue the treatment. Swap to TOFA. Swap to a different TNF than the one she was receiving initially, or you're not sure what to do here. And there were a couple questions about veto and pregnancy. So that's perfect setup. What do you guys want to do? Okay, let's see the answers. Okay, experienced audience, or they just all want to get out of here. That's a good answer. Continue treatment as is, impressive, and you've been listening to some of our other wonderful speakers here. So we certainly do know a bit about our biological therapies in pregnancy, Vedolizumab has not been an exception in that we don't think it's actively transmitted across the placenta in the early developmental phases of the pregnancy. And in general, now the current recommendation is you continue therapy through pregnancy. And in fact, there's now a pregnancy care pathway in IBD. You should go to the AGA website. There's a wonderful new resource for pregnant women and for mothers with IBD. I encourage you to check it out and share it with your patients. But the bottom line is it tells you all about the safety of these therapies in pregnancy, in breastfeeding, and talks about even management of your newborn if you have IBD. It's a really great resource, and I highly suggested.
And just a quick pearl on this, because I know we're out of time. The medications we do not use in pregnancy, okay, which you know are the methotrexate, the thalidomide, which nobody uses now, tofacitinib, we stop with it for 3 months prior to conception. And I never start thiopurine as the first time in pregnancy because of the risk of pancreatitis. All the other monoclonal antibodies, including vedolizumab, are okay.
So since it's our new therapy, do you want to elaborate at all on TOFA?
Yeah, so as far as tofacitinib, until we have more data, if a patient's on tofacitinib, we're not recommending pregnancy on tofacitinib. So we do stop tofacitinib, ideally 3 months prior to conception, although the drug clears very quickly. It's renally excreted. So within 24 hours, the drug leaves the system, unlike some of the other therapies. But that currently we're recommending 3 months prior to conception.
All right, we have time for a few more questions, so I'm gonna take them, and we'll still get everyone out on time, I promise. Wonderful questions. So just to clarify, you continue anti-TNF while treating with vanco for C. diff?
Yes.
I do as well. All right, does duration of symptoms impact response to therapy like we see with Crohn's?
Symptoms?
Or disease.
Disease.
Does duration of disease a predictor of lack of response to therapy?
So I think generally that is a patient who probably has more fibrosis and is less likely to respond. However, it's not something I would use in terms of not treating them and sending them straight to surgery, which is different in Crohn's disease. Strictures go to surgery, in my opinion. Long-standing UC with symptoms, I would certainly try to treat them first, although they may be less responsive.
Yeah, and forgive me, but I think there's a recent pub in press that suggests that it's not as likely in UC that we have that issue. But maybe that's because many patients with UC get to treatment a little earlier, but I think it's a very thoughtful question. Miguel, when would you use adalimumab or golimumab instead of infliximab in a UC patient?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I mean, I will say just for full disclosure, infliximab has generally been my first UC treatment because it's weight-based and for the reasons David said, a lot of times they're protein clearing. I think if you have a milder patient, it's probably reasonable to use adalimumab or golimumab. You know there's a high-dose adalimumab study. So adalimumab works for UC, it's just underdosed. So it's 160 each week times 4, very high loading dose. And we're probably going to find that that actually is effective. So it's just we're underdosing.
Would you have given a second anti-TNF after loss of response to the first anti-TNF?
Again, it depends. So if they have good drug levels, no antibodies, and they're failing, I switch out of class. If they have high antibodies and they had responded to an anti-TNF, then yes, I would go to a second anti-TNF.
So my answer to that question is it depends what my first anti-TNF was. If I'm using an injectable, I might consider going to IV infliximab before I go on to something else if they had a really robust response to it. But if I started with IV infliximab and dose escalated, I would not give an injectable unless they had immunogenicity as the reason for loss of response. What's the prudent, practical approach to a patient who you're sure has UC, you've been following them for a while, and they have a stricture in their sigmoid colon? What's going on there?
So obviously the teaching is we always worry about cancer in these patients, and I still think we need to look out for that. We have seen luminal narrowing in our patients with chronic UC. Before I came to the conference, we had an abdominal x-ray on a newly admitted patient in the hospital, classic lead pipe colon with a dilated colon above that. So the left colon was collapsed and very narrowed. When we scoped them, it wasn't a true stricture, but there was clearly luminal narrowing. And as David mentioned, this represents structural changes. So yes, we worry about cancer. I also have discussions about surgery in those patients because I think we get to an irreversible component in that.
I would just say to you that just be humble in the face of a stricture in your UC patient. Biopsies of the mucosa may not identify a submucosal neoplasm. I personally have been burned on that one time with a wonderful patient who thankfully is doing well now, but the reality is that you can miss it, and if you have to explain this in a reasonable way, and if you are unable to understand it and you don't think it's Crohn's, then you really do have to be suggesting a surgical approach, and watching and waiting can be the wrong thing to do there. So we have a few more minutes. One of them is pouchitis. Is that one of the complications we worry about in a patient who's had C. diff prior to surgery? I mentioned our study from the University of Chicago, and pouchitis was something we looked at, but that wasn't the specific endpoint, but yes, it is one of the options. What else?
So I think pouchitis in general, there are multiple phases of pouchitis, and we're still learning. And I'll just briefly break down into two categories pouchitis: those that are entirely microbiome driven, which means probably antibiotics and probiotics VSL number 3 work, and those that are antibiotic refractory, which are these immune mediated pouchitis. Is it Crohn's disease? Is it some other entity? We don't know. If it's an immune mediated pouchitis, and certainly if they have ulcers extending above the pouch, it's more Crohn's like. That does open the opportunity for biologic therapy, and we have used vedolizumab, we've used anti-TNFs, and I've even had some tofacitinib patients with that. If it's very bad pouchitis and they're failing, we've used biologics. At some point, we need to either look at redo pouches, which are being done a lot at Cleveland Clinic, so the second pouch, or a permanent ileostomy.
Great. Miguel, you still using thiopurines?
I use them in combination with anti-TNF. I have gotten away from using the monotherapy, but I will acknowledge, and probably many of you in the room have patients on them doing extremely well. They probably do work in about 20 to 25% of more Crohn's patients than UC, but we've all before biologics had great success with them. I think that just with the new era, I'm using them less as monotherapy.
I occasionally still use them. Patient has to be very steroid responsive for me to even consider it. You still checking TPMT before you use them?
Yes, absolutely. That should be done in everybody.
Me too. That was one of our questions here. Okay, how about veto levels? Is there a specific target or a level that's been associated with response and remission?
So my honest answer is that I'm curious, you might have a different opinion. My honest answer is I don't know. And the veto levels right now to me are hard to interpret. And so for that very reason, I'm more likely, unless they have very high antibodies to veto, which is what I'm primarily using the therapeutic drug levels, very high antibodies to veto, I switch to something else. No antibodies to veto, loss of response, I'm going to every 4 weeks.
Great. Here's one that I think is interesting. A patient on tofacitinib, 10 milligrams BID, but loses response and is now on steroids and tofa 10 BID. What would you consider?
Yeah, so that's so I'm not dose escalating, if that's the question. I think it depends where you are in the treatment paradigm. That's honestly a patient that currently today has probably been on other therapies, and that's a patient that I'm talking about surgery. I don't like using tofa with steroids too long. My rule is try to get them overlapping for a month, and I try not to use steroids longer than that with tofa. But if they're failing tofa, especially if they've been on something else and it's really IBD, I'm having a surgery discussion.
Yeah, I think that a surgery discussion is appropriate there. I'll just add that, and I'm not here to promote off-label use of therapies, but in the original clinical trial development of tofa, they did look at 15 BID, which was more effective than 10 BID in a small number of patients. That was discontinued, not specifically because of an obvious higher risk of infections, but if you're gonna consider it, I wouldn't do it more than a week or so in an immediate response from the patient, but it's not a sustainable strategy. So you do have to continue thinking about surgery and, of course, clinical trial options. A couple people here asked about when ustekinumab might be available for UC and other things that are coming down the road, like someone asked about the injectable version of vedolizumab. So do you want to comment on those, and then we'll wrap?
I think the short answer is I think we're going to see both of those in 2019. So I think we're going to see them both soon.
So injectable veto is going to be monthly?
So injectable Vita will be monthly, sorry. Yeah, as far as dosing. And I do think that will be a nice alternative to our patients. I think the ustekinumab we should see this year.
Great. So we have a final slide here, which are what they call SMART goals. And I worked with the CME Outfitter Group to put these together. They're specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. So what we hope you will leave today with all the other pearls that Miguel and I shared, stratify your risk in your patients with UC. Make decisions not just on how sick they are, but on their risk. Measure mucosal inflammation in objective ways. Remember, symptom control is necessary, but not sufficient. Initiate therapy to achieve targets and work with your patients to identify what those targets should be, but the recommendation is a composite of symptom control with objective measures of disease control. And lastly, optimize your therapies based on safety, efficacy, I would say pharmacokinetics, and availability. We all recognize that you leave these sessions and say, that sounds great, but I can't get it, and we know that's a challenge, and we also hope our new guidelines will help you with some more ammunition when you're working to get those therapies. So I want to thank Miguel. I really enjoyed this. I felt like this was a really interactive session with all of you. Wonderful questions from the audience. A thanks to our sponsor, Takeda, and the resources are available online. And if you complete the post-test and evaluation, which I hope you all will, you will then also be able to get your CME certificates. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for coming to the Crohn's and Colitis Congress. I hope that I'll all see many of you or all of you and your partners in Austin, Texas next year for the next Crohn's and Colitis Congress. And I wish you all good luck at the tables.